from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, despite a significant reduction in the proportion of the world population living in extreme poverty in recent decades, billions still lack access to food, shelter, clean water, and other basic necessities. And it is because of this, says investor in UC Region Richard Blum, people of means need to do more to relieve those struggling in developing countries. He'll join us to discuss his new book, An Accident of Geography, Compassion, Innovation, and the Fight Against Poverty, which tells the stories of dozens of successful approaches used to advance global development and alleviate extreme poverty. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. San Francisco born and bred, Richard Blum is as well known and respected for his private equity and investment accomplishments as he is for his philanthropy. A University of California regent and founder of the Blum Center for Developing Economies at UC Berkeley, and actually all through the UC system now. He's also founder and chair of the American Himalayan Foundation, and he recently published a book called An Accident of Geography, Compassion, Innovation, and the Fight Against Poverty. It's a book which has all the earmarks of being an important document in terms of understanding poverty in greater depth and really actually doing something about it. And Dick Blum, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Welcome. Let me begin, actually, by, I want to cover a lot because your book covers a lot, but maybe we ought to begin by asking perhaps one of the most important questions of all, because your book is really about doing good, and it's about doing good particularly in terms of ameliorating and reducing, diminishing poverty. Why do good, especially in this age of Trump?
Well, I was asked that question on another television show, and they said, which would you rather do, take the money and spend it on yourself, as the president-elect has pretty well done, or try and help other people who are less fortunate and make their lives better. To me, it's pretty simple. Why wouldn't you?
It's a good retort. You're just really trying to make a better world, or does it come out of I always hate to use this word because it sounds so academic, eleemosynary sense, or a sense, in other words, of altruism and wanting to give?
Yeah, it's the latter. Let me explain it this way. I first went to the Himalayas when the people barely knew where Nepal was 49 years ago. And I went for a month with a Sherpa who became a close friend until he passed away, and I'm godfather to his children and his grandchildren. His grandchildren, his oldest grandson just graduated from USF and is now working as an accountant at Deloitte Touche, making $60,000 a year. When I met Pasankami, who I'm referring to, he was making $10 a month the year before working for the Indian Army. And he had five daughters, and he said to me, look, if my daughters don't receive an education and aren't married, they will spend the rest of their lives carrying loads up and down the mountains. And I was so touched by his caring for me when I walked through those mountains 49 years ago, which it was a very foreign land. The trails were narrower. We went through some pretty hair-raising stuff. But he and the other Tibetan porters who were with me, they took care of me, not in a, servitude kind of sense. They took care of me because I was a fellow sentient being. It's a very Buddhist thing.
Drawn to Tibetan Buddhism ever since, haven't you?
Yes. Most religions preach it. I think the people who live in the mountains, maybe it's because they live in the mountains and maybe because they do need each other, really practice it. And not surprisingly, the two people I admire the most and been fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with are both His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Jimmy Carter, who is very much of the same make. And
who wrote the introduction to your book, in fact. And by tallying, and I don't know how much how we come to these numbers, but that epiphany you had in 1968 has led to a foundation, the Himalayan Foundation, which has helped some 300,000 people. I mean, this is an extraordinary track record, and kudos to you for all your service on that, and particularly in Nepal and Bhutan, but also in Tibet and India. What about the question, and I'll get to it along with other questions about your philanthropy, but what about the question that often looms of, what about here at home? There's also terrible poverty here, or Latin America and so forth.
We will never run short of poor people who need help.
You've been localized, though, pretty much, haven't you? Focused more on that Himalayan region?
Well, you know, my wife being Diane Feinstein, we have done a lot for the city. But no, in terms of where my major focus is, it's Nepal. It's a very poor country. And every day we toy with what do you contribute next to. And we now have 15,000 young girls who we have saved from being sold into prostitution in school in Nepal. And every time somebody asks us for a contribution to one thing or another, KQED being an exception, we always want to help KQED, is that you say, well, gee, I can help the symphony, or I can help more young girls get into school and not cross the border into India into prostitution.
Talk about how you do that, because, I mean, sex trafficking is a universal problem and a terrible problem of young girls, I mean, as young as like sometimes 7, 8 years old.
Yes.
And the reality is, I mean, you write about this in the book, dealing with the corruption that hovers over all of this.
There is corruption everywhere. You don't need to go to Nepal to find this kind of a problem. We got it right here in the Bay Area, and especially in Oakland. There's a lot of sex trafficking.
But let's talk about, again, ways to ameliorate it. I mean, you've got sex trafficking, and you've got corruption, and you've got, therefore, a kind of witch's brew to have to fight against in terms of ways to fight against it.
Well, it's poverty. And look, I think the only real way out of inequality is through education. It's one of the reasons I spend so much time at the University of California.
Which we should mention, you're a region, yeah.
But it's a long battle, and I don't think most of us will ever live to see it go away. But a lot of people have been brought out of poverty in the last 10 or 15 years, and a lot of them are in China. I don't like the Chinese government. I don't like particularly the way they treat the Tibetan people. But if you said in terms of really making people's lives better, the Chinese government has done a pretty good job.
You don't like them, but you do business with them?
Yeah, I actually don't so much anymore. I have left some money with partners over there, and they invest some funds for me. I don't really – I go there maybe once a year, and it's really never – personally involved in the business side of things. But I have never for one moment, going back to the time of Jiang Zemin, been anything but clear to them that I think their attitude towards the Tibetans and the way they treat them is terrible.
Talking with Richard Blum, who is president of Blum Capital Partners LP, also author of a book called An Accident of Geography, Compassion, Innovation, and the Fight Against Poverty. He's also a California regent, and I want to talk to you about the title of your book. But let's talk more about extreme poverty, because as you kind of alluded to, it's been cut since 1990 by over half, which is really extraordinary. But we've still got 1 in 5 people in developing regions living on less than $1.25 a day, and 836 million people in extreme poverty. Those are huge numbers.
Yes, they are. And
they're daunting.
They're daunting. And you could either throw up your hands and say, there's nothing I can do about it, or, you know, the old saying, do them one at a time and just understand no individual is going to maybe make a major dent. But I think the fact that we touched 350,000 people in Nepal with our programs, you know, for those 350,000 people, life's a little better.
Where does your life as a financier or an investment guy fit into this picture? What's the paradigm, and how does that fit into ameliorating poverty?
Well, basically, increasingly, I don't spend a lot of time on our business. I have other people run it. Increasingly, a lot of it is domestic real estate run out of our group in Dallas. And so I have other people running pieces of our business, and I really focus much more on, okay, if we have excess funds. I mean, I do have 4 daughters and 7 grandkids. Once you get past taken care of and they're in pretty good shape, then the rest, the question is, what do you do with the rest of your funds? And to me, a lot of it is just global poverty. I think there's a reason you want to do it as a matter of foreign policy, and it goes like this. If you went to Nepal today, it's a little country, but it's bordered by 2 big countries, India and China. It has not a very good government. They're corrupt and they're inept. And I say that as their honorary consul general. But the people on the street like Americans. Why do they like Americans? Goes all the way back to the Peace Corps. And then, of course, you had climbers and trekkers, and you had people like the American Himalayan Foundation. So no matter what the government is like, we know the people there, and we know how to work with them. And by the way, most of the ideas for brilliant projects come from the people in the villages, not from us. And it's surprising. And I learned this from Sir Edmund Hillary, who was our partner for 20 years before he passed away. You spend time in the villages, you get to know the people, you understand what needs to be done. And we just screen lots of ideas and then fund the ones we like. So we're not the geniuses here. The people in the countryside are. Now, if you take a step back further, and 4 or 5 years ago, when we were spending too much time in the same places like Afghanistan and Iraq, they couldn't find enough Arab speakers. So you wonder if for 60 years you had the same interest in those countries with Americans going there, whether we wouldn't have known better what to do in those countries, or maybe we would have decided not to do anything at all.
Well, we used to sign ambassadors who didn't even know the language. I mean, you get an ambassadorial post because, political influence and so forth. But you're talking about a kind of person-to-person diplomacy, which is a strong argument in your book. It's a strong argument that you've pretty much held up for years now.
Yeah, but here's the good thing about it. Because of our center at Berkeley and now at all 10 campuses, some are growing faster than others. Places like Irvine are doing particularly well, UC San Diego and so forth. Just out of Berkeley alone, we have sent kids to 80 different countries. And they're enthusiastic before they go there, and when they come back, they're even more enthusiastic. I ran into a woman about 6 months ago. She said, "You don't know who I am, but I run the Peace Corps program in Berkeley. We're inundated by your people." So it's not like young people don't want to do this stuff. In fact, they do want to do it. And one of the things I would have hoped for, and I think could have happened if Hillary got elected, is an expansion of these programs. I don't know what's going to happen with Trump. He's talking about cutting foreign assistance dramatically. We'll see what happens. I think that would be a very bad decision. But there's all these other countries that maybe you can recreate Nepal's and have close relationships with, and I think if we believe our way of life is a better way than dictatorships, to the extent that people in little countries that are poor learn more about us and we can help them move along, I think we'll have a better world.
Well, you're not only talking about sending people out, all of the Peace Corps. I know, in fact, in your book you talk about being inspired by John F. Kennedy and think about what Sergeant Shriver did and all that notion of the Peace Corps. But it seems to me you're also thinking about research about how to establish. I mean, that's what the UCs are doing now under this Blum Foundation.
Yes. What we've done is take a number of existing classes that say okay, if you're going to run a something, some little foundation in some country, what is it that you need to know? One of the things I want them all to do is take a business course, because we found a lot of young people with good ideas that start, you know, a hospital or a school and over these places don't know how to run anything, and they often fail. So we want them to take a business course. But our major association is with the School of Engineering, because if you look at what brings about change, it's innovation, and where does it come from? It comes from engineering. But then, you know, there's anthropology, there is law, there is – we have kids from 51 different majors at Berkeley being minors in global poverty. I didn't know there was 51 majors in Berkeley, but they say there are, and they're in our classes.
We're talking again with Richard Blum. His book is called An Accident of Geography, Compassion, Innovation, and the Fight Against Poverty. I said I was going to talk with you a little bit about the title here, because I was struck by we're all lucky to live in this country. We're lucky to be where we are. We're lucky to be born where we are. And you pretty much pressed that idea home. And
exactly.
It creates more compassion, perhaps, to realize just how lucky we are as opposed to so many who are born in different time and place.
You know, the nice thing about all this is if you really get into it, and you understand what people's problems are, and you help some kid go to school or start a business or whatever, they'll feel good about it, but so will you. And there's not a moment of time or money that I've ever spent on these things that I've ever regretted.
Well, you got a lot of stories in the book. What
some story? Of them are even true.
Well, this is not fiction. But what do you think of, if I ask you this, the old Malcolm Gladwell thing, you know, the first thing that comes off in the top of your head may be significant. Which story particularly resonates for you? Which story would you want to tell, for example, these many listeners who are hearing this?
I would say it's the one with Pasankami. As I say, I've been godfather to his family. He's since passed away for over 40 years. And it's when he told me that some trekkers brought him over here, and he'd never hardly been out of the mountains, and it's bang, New York City, moved him across the country. I'm the last one to take care of him, San Francisco. I got to send him on a plane back to Nepal. And I said, everybody called him PK, even his wife. I said, PK, what does this mean to you? And this is about, if my daughters aren't educated, they'll spend their lives carrying loads up and down the mountains. And we reflected on that many years afterwards. And he said, it was one of the happiest days of my life. I said, it was one of the happiest days of my life. And that association with that family and the fact to this very day, I understand not all of the problems, but I understand a lot of the problems. A lot of people won't pay attention to stuff because they don't feel it in their gut. They don't really understand what's happening in Guatemala or Mexico or El Salvador. And increasingly, by the way, we're starting to work with Luis Alberto Moreno, who runs the Inter-American Development Bank, who's Colombian, who's a terrific guy and doing more in Latin America. I said, hey, let's not forget Latin America. In fact, our center in UCLA is all about healthcare in Latin America.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because in reading your book, I couldn't help thinking about a kind of triage and how it would work. I mean, like I said, a lot of your focus has been on Himalaya and countries around that area. But I keep thinking about the fact that we have so many people who want to come to this country for opportunity, for education, to make a better life out of poverty, out of violence and so forth. Think about what's coming through Latin America. Think about what's coming through Syria and the Middle East and so forth. Where do you put priorities here?
Well, you know, let's face it. Donald Trump got elected to a certain extent by being anti-immigrant. I don't think that's how most Californians think. If you look at the state and you now have...
We had about 65% who voted against Donald Trump in this state.
Yeah, my guess is... If there were a legal count, it probably would have been higher. I'm joking. In any event...
Well, he just said that all these illegals voted against him. He should have had the popular vote. That's the most recent statement from Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, if you want to listen to that, good luck. the history of this country and what's dynamism is about is people who came from lands where they just had to get out. We're all immigrants, unless you're Native American, you're an immigrant. My family's been here for a long time, but, 150 years ago, they came from Germany and France. And so now they come from Syria or they come from Latin America. And by and large, I've seen it just in people we know that have come from the Himalayan region or whatever. When they come here, they understand the opportunity they have. And by and large, they really work their tails off. Huh. That's not true about everybody. And there's some of them, wind up being in gangs and involved in drugs and so forth. But let's talk about the ones that have succeeded. I mean, look at the companies down the peninsula that have changed the world we live in. And look where some of the founders are from. They're from India. They're from China. They're from Russia. Now, we should be doing a better job of educating more of our own. That's why I care so much about the University of California. So let everybody has an equal chance, no matter where they're from.
How does being a region help promote that or advance that?
Well, the University of California, count the whole system, 10 campuses, you're talking about 240,000 students. And the problem is funding it properly. And we don't get enough from the state. And the state, of course, has other priorities. But to give you some idea, 20 years ago, we got about the same amount of money from the state as we get today, about $2.5 billion. But yet we now educate 68,000 more students with the same amount of money. Most people don't understand that. You say, well, how do you do that? Well, you increase tuition, which is you don't want to do, and you increase class size, which you don't want to.
And you bring in more students out of state who pay higher.
And we brought in more students out of state. I don't know how much higher it is than it was 20 years ago, but there is a differential now. It's the difference between $13,000 a year, more or less, if you're in state, and $20,000 if you're from out of state.
We're talking to Richard Blum, and his new book is all about compassion, innovation, and the fight against poverty. It's called An Accident of Geography. We invite your involvement in the program, and we'd like to hear from you. If you have questions or comments for Richard Blum related to the many roles he plays and has played and continues to play, we welcome you to join the conversation. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us with questions or comments. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have right onto our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Richard Blum. Richard Blum is president of Blum Capital Partners, LP. He's also the author of a book called An Accident of Geography, Compassion, Innovation, and the Fight Against Poverty. He's also a University of California regent, and he is, of course, the husband of Senator Dianne Feinstein. How does that figure into your life now and your philanthropy and your causes?
Well, first of all, my wife has always been an inspiration, and you think of all the things that she tried to accomplish as mayor of San Francisco and now a senator for 23 years. Interesting thing is she is now the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee. And so you've got Supreme Court justices that's going to come before the Judiciary Committee. I'm not sure how good Democrats can be in stopping a nomination because
they're outnumbered.
you're outnumbered.
Yeah.
But immigration also comes before the Judiciary Committee, and it sounds like maybe World War III before that battle gets resolved.
Your thoughts? Your thoughts and reflections upon this election, the results of this election?
I was shocked, absolutely shocked. It never occurred to me that Donald Trump could get elected president. And I was chairman of C.B. Richard Ellis, which is big, world's largest real estate services company, for a long time. I'm not really a real estate guy, but it was a private equity deal, and we did very well with it over the years. Not surprisingly, they had the biggest real estate services office in New York City. They know this guy, and all I can do is refer you to all those stories that were in the New York Times about his business dealings. I never heard anybody say that they weren't true. He's not a good guy.
But he's our president now.
Yeah.
Let's go to our callers. But before I do that, a comment from Kelly. Why would Richard Blum propose to develop condominiums at the Berkeley Claremont Hotel site? This is very disturbing to us Claremont neighbors and for the Berkeley community at large.
Well, first of all, we think the land at the Claremont Hotel, number one, is we took a broken down hotel that's been there for 100 years and spent a lot of money redoing it. And I think most people who go there today are really delighted with it. And I did it because it was sort of a Berkeley community, Berkeley University thing. The land is on 25 acres. It's badly used. There is a corner where the condominiums are going to be built. It doesn't block anybody's views. And the amount of traffic that will increase because you have 40 condominiums that are built there versus what comes in and out of the hotel daily doesn't amount to much. But, you know, there's NIMBYs out there that just don't want them built. And I understand that. And, you know, it'll get sorted out in Oakland. And I'm sure there'll be compromises along the line. And hope it works out all right.
Your compassion and your feeling of compassion and you're elevating that to a major point of life, really, come from your Buddhist practice? How much of it comes from your Buddhist practice?
I don't know where it really comes from. My mother was always a volunteer for everything, whether it was Mount Zion Hospital or was a museum or so forth. Whether it comes from the fact that, you know, my wife has led a life dedicated to public service. Clearly, seeing how people in the Himalayas treated each other, which has its tenets in Buddhism. But the Dalai Lama doesn't think I'm a very good Buddhist in a training, educational sense. So he and Richard Gere, I'm on the East Coast, I'm known as the other Richard. So Richard Gere is a very devout Buddhist, practices every day. So His Holiness and Richard Gere got me a couple of years ago and he said, look, we like the way you behave, but we wish you were a better student. So they gave me this book that was written by an Indian sage about 2,000 years ago. And His Holiness said, read chapter 6 and read chapter 8. And if you have trouble sleeping, read chapter 9. So he has a sense of humor about it. But at any rate, I'm trying to do a little bit better.
You ever think of running for public office?
No.
Not at any interest at all?
No, there was a time after Diane was mayor that some people came to me and wanted me to run for mayor. And I said, we'd had it in our family for 9 years. I'd rather just be supportive of my wife. I have zero interest in running for public office, particularly now that I'm not so young anymore. But I didn't want to do it even 30 years ago. I'd rather do what I'm doing.
Let me get to our callers. And by the way, I'll tease your book a little bit. There's a story in here about finance that probably anybody interested in money, when your grandmother gave you 10 grand essentially to invest, that anybody who's interested in just the way, the vicissitudes and variations.
How to inherit $10,000 and lose it.
And lose it, yeah. No, it was an important lesson to you in some ways.
Yes,
in that world as it was going to the Himalayas. Let's get our callers on here, though. Kylie is joining us first. Kylie, welcome.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
Hi.
Yeah, firstly, I just wanted to say kudos to Mr. Blum. I wish that, you know, more people with the means could actually provide, like you have. So, you know, thank you for that. My question is really around, what advice do you give people without the financial means that you have to contribute to those ways? Is it, you know, the obvious answer through charities and volunteering? But I'd like to hear in your words what your thoughts are.
Well, look, my point of this book is that anybody can start something. When we had six scruffy guys came off of Mount Everest in 1981 and said, let's do something, that was the start of the American Himalayan Foundation. So here we are 30-some-odd years later, and all this stuff is kind of grown out of it. I never would have expected we would have done what we've done. So I would say you can do one of two things. You can find a worthwhile cause like the American Himalayan Foundation, and if you got an extra few dollars, send it to them. But you should know what we're doing, and we can send you an annual report, or you can look at on our website, which is HimalayanFoundation.org. I guess it was okay to say that.
It was definitely okay to say that.
But you know, maybe you can find something. You don't need to go all the way to the Himalayas. Poverty surrounds us. You know, you can look at San Francisco. I've lived here all my life. I've never seen the economy boom the way it is here or down the peninsula. You drive over the hill and, you know, you go to a place like one of our newest campuses, UC Merced, and there's poverty everywhere. So you don't need to go far to find somebody to help. You got to find out what is it that you care most about. I've been involved with Glide Memorial and Cecil Williams for years. And, you know, what they have done for homeless and feeding them, housing them, and so forth and so on is amazing. And there's a lot of good organizations right here that you can help.
And let me thank you for that call, and we'll go right to another caller. Let's go to Bonnie. Bonnie, you're on.
Yes, hi. I was just thinking that we kind of create the instability in these countries by creating markets for drugs and also from our industrial war complex and also through perpetuating the poverty industry. And so I just think we should be held responsible for the byproduct of our influence on most of these countries where we're receiving immigrants.
Agree, Dick Blum?
Yeah, I guess. Absolutely.
All right, we thank the caller. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Jess. Jess, join us.
Oh, is this me?
If you're Jess, it's you.
Yeah, I'm Jeff. First of all, I can't thank you enough for what you're doing. Ideally, we are learning a lot from your experiences. My question is, does the Blum Foundation partner with other nonprofits that are working in impoverished countries, or vice versa? Is there a way for a nonprofit that could tap into the immense knowledge and experience that you've amassed over the years? The lessons that you've learned could help nonprofits at least avoid the many failures and learn from the successes, like I'm thinking about Jeffrey Sachs and the Millennium Project, especially in places like where my nonprofit, Care for Peace, is working in Burma. There's very, very important reasons for us to succeed, and we are doing everything we can to learn from people, but it seems to me that your knowledge and experience would be an incredible thing for us to tap into. Is it possible?
Sure. There are so many hours in the day, and I'm not so young anymore, but we're happy to we have our American Himalayan Foundation team who also looks at other projects. We got our center over at Berkeley that's willing to look at other projects. I mean, we do look at a lot of other opportunities. We have a new fund that I brought in Rajiv Shah, who used to run Agency for International Development. And we're putting together a fund, and this is to bring clean electricity to mainly southern Africa, both hydro and solar. And it was really – he was inspired by Obama's trip to Africa. And if you do this right, I don't think we can do it, but we can do part of it if it gets going, is in a period of 20 years to bring electricity to 40% of southern Africa. If you do that, and I've spent a lot of time, we haven't been talking about it, with Jimmy Carter and gone to if you list the worst places to go to in Africa, I've been there with Jimmy Carter. And
Sudan? And,
yes. And by the way, if you have an opportunity to go to southern Sudan, turn it down. You'll probably get killed. And it's too bad because, you know, a lot of the fighting, a lot of tribal warfare, a lot of problem with drug dealing and so forth, it's all because of poverty. And it doesn't mean that they weren't poor, that they necessarily get along, but they probably get along better.
Talking with Regent Richard Blum, who is president of Blum Capital Partners and author of An Accident of Geography, Compassion, Innovation, and the Fight Against Poverty. I want to go to more of your calls. But first, let me go to some of your comments. Pat writes, it's one thing to disagree with the president-elect's policy, but disingenuous for Mr. Blum and Michael to start the segment saying President-elect Trump only cares about himself. His campaign resonated with a lot of people who have been left out by elitist, corrupt, and uncaring policies of the establishment factions of both parties. This should be a wake-up call to not take a non-existing high road.
Let's see what happens. Look, he is the president-elect. I'm just looking at his track record. I hope he turns over another leaf. We're silly not to hope that he succeeds.
Another listener writes, I'm glad to know Mr. Blum is such a philanthropic person, but he has had a huge role in minimizing and selling our great post offices around the country for his own enrichment. There are many people in my circles that find Blum a person who is anything but interested in the welfare of many postal workers and citizens. You have an interest in CBRE group. I think that's what this
Let me tell you, that story is total
bunk.
Yeah, I was going to say bull something.
Yeah.
There is not a truth, any truth to it all. I've never had gotten one nickel out of it. I think CBRE got the assignment to sell some post office. CBRE is a big company. It's a $13 billion company. Our interest in it in the last few years, it's now none, was minimal. You couldn't figure out what that would have meant to us. And I don't even know how many post offices they ever got sold. It was a total made-up story.
Here's David who writes, both the UC system and the CSU systems are incredibly important and underfunded resources for the state of California. The UC system has historically received more support than the CSU system. Would it not be in the best interest of the people of California for the UC and the CSU systems to work together to improve support for education?
Absolutely. And we're trying to do this because what you want is increase the transfer rate from the state CSU system into UC. So if you're going to Fresno State and you live nearby and you can live at home, it's less expensive in terms of tuition. It's less expensive in terms of living expense. And after 2 years, if you can transfer into a UC school, and at the end of the day, at the end of 4 years, you walk out with a UC diploma, we want to see more of that.
And we want to hear more of your calls, so let me go to them. And let me go next to Emma in Palo Alto. You're on. Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, my question is, he mentioned that there are so many immigrants came to the United States and worked so hard and become successful. How can we then collect them, have a collective effort to give back to the country? How can we use the diaspora to help alleviate the poverty in their own country?
Okay, thank you for that question, Emma. Dick Blum, did you hear all that? Because it was a little breaking in and out.
Look, the only way it seems to work is, and you see it particularly in places like India and China, where people come over here. They get a good education. They start a business here, or they go back to particularly we're seeing a fair amount of in India and recreate those businesses in their homeland, and with a fair amount of success. I don't know that there's a real policy for doing this. I think it just happens because people learn here and then go home and try to start things in their homeland. I think to the extent that that happens, and you know, there's been great companies and wealth created all the way from Japan, Korea, China, India, you know, mainly in Asia, Singapore. Indonesia is doing better. So is Thailand's been up and down. But standard living in those places is much better than it was. A lot of it's just created internally, but some of it is because people were well educated and learned how to grow businesses from what they learned over here.
Well, you alluded earlier to China's economic success, and it's pretty extraordinary by any standards. But what about those million Tibetans, you know, who died because of Chinese occupation? And what can be done to bring pressure? It seems like in many ways American presidents, I don't know if it's going to change under Trump, have sort of shrugged their shoulders as ways to bring pressure to bear upon the Chinese with violations of human rights of all kinds, but particularly with respect to Tibet.
Well, going back to Jiang Zemin when he was party secretary, we knew Jiang very well because he'd been mayor of Shanghai, and the sister city with my wife started with Shanghai and San Francisco back in, I guess it was really 1978-79, continues today. And so Jiang's someone we've known for 30-some-odd years. I actually met with him about 4 months ago. He's now 90 years old. He's retired. We used to have vigorous discussions with him over Tibet. He would listen to us. We tried numerous times to make certain things happen. We tried to get the Dalai Lama and Jiang Zemin in the same room. I worked with President Clinton on it. Both Bill Clinton and I told Jiang, if you ever met the Dalai Lama, you guys would like each other, and I actually believed it. And then in the end, Jiang was willing to meet with the Dalai Lama and the hardline group, the Li Peng crowd, pulled him back. And since then, you can't even talk to them about Tibet.
It's hardliner. Yeah, much
no, hardliner. No, you bring up Tibet and they yell at you. So I don't even try anymore, but I can tell you Hillary tried and didn't get anywhere.
What do you think is going to happen under Trump? I mean, he's totally unpredictable in many ways, but he said he doesn't. He's been very critical of China. He's talked about, well, it's going to obviously go south as far as TPP. In fact, it's not going to be upheld, I don't think. We can pretty much reckon.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to know, because the one thing you're finding out about Trump is that what he said during the campaign, he's starting to reverse a lot of the stuff, which I find encouraging.
You think he's going to name Romney Secretary of State?
I don't think that's going to happen.
Because they're already angry at him for saying he wouldn't lock Hillary up, or you know, he may have to look over the climate change agreement from Paris. He's backpedaled on those things.
A well-known former president of the United States, you might be able to figure out who it is, asked a prominent Republican who was kind of a racetrack guy 6-8 months ago, which Republican was he going to support for the presidency? And he said, Trump. And he said, why are you going to support Trump? He says, because he doesn't believe a word that he says. And, you know, so to the extent and we, one of his key supporters and I are good friends. And he told me that. And I said, oh, you're just an apologist for this guy. And but now you're seeing him back off in some of these extreme positions. I think he's got a problem because he promised he'd do this, that, the other thing.
And he set a tone, too.
And he set a tone.
Yeah.
And he's got a lot of angry people even more angry. But, you know, you got Congress. And a lot of stuff that you want to get done, you got to get by the Senate. And he's also filling out his cabinet with, you know, a lot of them are pretty right-wing folks, but they're not stupid. They do understand the government, and they understand the limitations of government. So I think it's too early to know. But, I mean, I was happy to have him decide that, well, maybe driving too many cars around with fuel emissions, not what they ought to be, is a problem for climate change. I'm glad he discovered that. I think he knew it all along. I don't know what he's going to do about Cuba. I'm not sure in the scheme of things it matters all that much, although I hope they move towards normalization. It's kind of silly not to. But I also understand why a lot of Cubans were not unhappy to see Fidel pass.
He's a good capitalist. He would promote, you know, there's a lot of investment possibilities in Cuba.
And by the way, the Cuban people are smart, energetic people. All you got to do is look at what they've done in this country, particularly in Florida.
Some comments from listeners. Mylon writes, I work with an organization that does development work all around the world. I'm wondering if Mr. Blum has any recommendations for people that we can talk to about successfully implementing volunteer construction projects for schools.
I don't know. The one thing I do know something about is because of Jimmy Carter's involvement is Habitat for Humanity. I mean, mainly they build housing. And
it's domestic.
No, it's not domestic.
Is it now all
it's
around the world?
It's mainly international.
Yeah.
In fact, I actually, as incompetent as I am with a hammer and nail, worked with him on a project down in Tijuana several years ago. I don't know what he thought of my skills, but I was never invited back.
Well, the fact of the matter is I know people who worked actually hammering nails and stuff, but it was always here in the United States. It's interesting to know that they've gone across borders. Norris asks, in your guest's opinion, why don't other super rich people think and act similarly philanthropic? How could those people be persuaded to use their wealth in more humane ways?
Well, I think there are some lights that are going on down the peninsula. You have people, like whether they're from Facebook or from Apple or Google, that have made extraordinary amounts of money in very short periods of time. And most of them are still pretty young. And so you just look around San Francisco. You have Mark Benioff, who's given $150 million to UCSF for their hospitals, the ones here and the one in Oakland. You have Zuckerberg, who is basically redoing the hospital, SF General. You have Sandy Weill, who's actually kind of made his money the old-fashioned way, investment banking, by building up and one time being controlling shareholder in Citigroup, now spends a lot of his time in Sonoma, and he's just given $185 million to make UCSF the number one neuroscience center in the world. They already are, and this will just make them all that much better. I've spent a fair amount of time getting those kind of projects going as a region. So you do see some people, particularly younger ones who have made it through the tech world, who all of a sudden have enormous amounts of money and say, you know, I really don't need $10 million. You know, I'll keep two and give eight away, or I'll keep eight and give two away. And so I see that changing. I hope it continues.
I asked about the effect of Buddhism on your compassion and your view and your philanthropy and everything, but you mentioned Zuckerberg and Benioff, who, like you, come from a Jewish background. How much does that play into this, do you think? Or how much does it with you? Has it with you?
I think it's part of the culture. If you look at a lot of the major institutions. I mean, you know, it goes back in kind of Jewish history that people had to become bankers because back 300 years ago they, in Europe, they weren't allowed to own land. And so, you know, it started with families like the Rothschilds and so forth. And, you know, it was in the tradition of the religion to do that. I don't know whether there's a conscious or a subconscious motivation to do this thing. I think with me, it's more subconscious. We weren't as a family particularly religious, although my mother volunteered for all the good things. My father, unfortunately, passed away when I was quite young. You know, walking into KQED, just look at your board of contributors. And I would say 80% of the major contributors, I just walk by that board, are from Jewish families.
We got to end it there. Dick Blum, good to have you on. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Dick Blum's book, again, is An Accident of Geography, Compassion, Innovation, and the Fight Against Poverty. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irina Gucci, and Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.